You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode of See Here is brought to you by the sweet sounds of Denise Waverly.
See Here, the music movie podcast. Morris, why am I doing this intro?
Because we have decided that we're going to be very democratic here on this program, and we're going to take it in turns from now on to be circus ringleaders. So, Wendy, you are the hostess with the mostest this time.
So you're saying we're going to take it in turns in the ring?
Yes, I'm going to take turns knocking each out. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah, Wendy, you take the reins.
All right. Yeah. Well, first of all, shouldn't we go around and talk about what we've been doing in the past month or so? What movies you've seen? What you've been up to?
I guess we should. All right. Well, okay. Well, who wants to go first? All right. I'll go first since you're all rushing into it. Hello. My name is Morris, and I'll do the quick intro. We got Bernie Sticky in Bath.
Hello.
We have
hello
Tim.
There.
Tim Merrill in Seoul, and we have the hostess with the mostest, Wendy Freeman in Chicago, and my name.
Oh, shouldn't the hostess be making these introductions more?
But she hasn't
already.
She hasn't done it, so I think
she's not going to learn unless you just let her get on and do it, Morris.
All right, okay, Wendy.
You know, I've never hosted a podcast before. What do I know?
Oh, no, double page spread.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll talk about what I've been watching and listening to recently. I'll just mention one film and one CD. So film that I watched over the last couple of days, and I'm sort of thinking this could actually possibly be a future contender for a See Here discussion. I'm not sure. See what you guys think. It's the first film directed by a French director called Jean-Jacques Benet. Now, the film is Diva, and I'd seen his film Betty Blue more times than I care to think, and it's not just because it has some great sex scenes in it. But,
yes, right, Morris.
And yeah, read Playboy for the articles as well. Betty Blue was, I got to say right off the bat that I'm no fan of the 3-hour director's cut. Sometimes when the studio says cut it down, they actually know what they're talking about. But the 2-hour version is one that I absolutely love and have watched countless times. So it just, I was in the library the other day and they had a copy of Diva, and I thought, I really should watch this and just see what else he's done. So I watch it. Have any of you guys seen Diva?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Okay, I haven't seen it for about 25 odd years, so I remember hardly anything about it. So.
All right, so for those of you out there who may not have seen it and don't know what the film's about, it's this fellow, he's a postman, but he also loves his music, and he goes off to a concert of an American opera singer who's, I can't remember the name of the actress, but she's gorgeous and has a beautiful voice, and he's completely smitten with her, and he records her concert. And she has this thing where she believes in the purity of the human voice and doesn't want to ever record in a studio, doesn't ever want to be recorded. She just wants to perform in concert, and that's it. So he goes and records. So basically, for his own personal thing, but he's making a bootleg, a classical bootleg, effectively. And the results are, it's a story of two tapes. There's his recording, which we got some shady record studio owners who want to sign her to their label, who want to get access to this tape that he has. But there's also another story completely where a cassette's been left in his motorcycle bag that's going to break open a European prostitution ring. So he's basically being chased by two people who want these two different tapes, or two different groups of people who want these tapes. And it's a bit thriller, and it's a bit love story, and it's very European looking. What is a European film? And it absolutely looks gorgeous. It gets a little bit convoluted at points, but it is definitely worth a watch. And for a first film, it's incredible. So I'd recommend that, Diva by Jean-Jacques Benet. And the CD I want to bring up that I got about, no, maybe a week and a half ago, is, it's a best of, and I know that some people sort of think that best ofs are lame, but I wanted to get into this. This is the best of John Doe thus far, or this far. And John Doe is the bass player and one of the lead singers of the group X. And we're going to be discussing with Eric Reanimator an X album in April. Actually, we're going to do, there are two bands called X. There's an Australian band called X. So I figured it might be a nice thing to discuss an album from each of the X's. So we're going
there's
to do,
also a band in Japan called X Japan, who had to change their name to X Japan.
Oh, really? Maybe yes. Want to throw them into the mix as well.
Yes. Their lead singer plays a glass piano.
Oh, what?
Why?
Yeah, and he wrote a comic book.
That's amazing. Well, very, very, very talented lead singer. But anyway, so on this album, it shows more of a, a rock and roll and countryside of John Doe. And as Eric put it to me during the week, he said, not knowing I'd already actually sort of bought this best of, he said, you ought to listen to some of John Doe's solo stuff. He's yet another case of a punk singer who's turned into a crusty old country singer. It's not quite, but it is a mixture of roots, rock, Americana sort of thing. And I'm really digging that. And I'm digging the X albums that I've been listening to over the last week as well. The best of John Doe this far. So that's what I've been grooving on in the last week or so.
Nice. Did you check out that Flesh Eaters LP yet, Morris? Did you get a chance to?
I haven't had a listen to that, although I did listen to a couple of tunes on YouTube after we last spoke.
Okay.
Sticky, and yeah, I didn't mind that, so I'm definitely looking forward to listening to that whole
Excellent.
Flesh Eaters. Is John Doe, on that album?
Because
I know he played on
no.
one or two of their albums. Okay.
Or is it? No, I think he is, actually. Yes, he is. I think it was a different lineup pretty much with every LP, but I believe John Doe's on that one. DJ Bonebreak is on that one. Dave nice. Alvin is on that one. Well, let me know when you get around to it, Morris.
Yeah, look, hopefully over the next week, I'd like to do that.
Nice. And for all you listeners out there, we're talking about A Minute to Pray, A Second to Die. Was it A Second to Pray, A Minute to Die by Flesh Eaters? Either way, it's great.
Excellent. No, looking forward to that. Thanks, Ben.
Tim?
All right. I'm in, I guess. I've been watching a number of documentaries, I guess, in research for some potential future episodes. First one I watched is the Grant Hart documentary.
Oh, man, how have I still not watched this?
Yeah, everything. It's really interesting retrospect into an artist that is kind of continuing to do his own thing or dance to the beat of his own drummer. No pun intended, but It's interesting to see the parallels between Grant Hart and Bob Mould, because the both of them, you know, were two linchpins in Husker Du, which was probably one of the biggest influential bands for me growing up in the 80s and 90s. I got lucky enough to see them on the last tour, and, you know, that just blew my mind. They were basically like the Beatles of punk rock to me. The documentary is just about the life of Grant Hart post Husker Du, and, you know, getting through certain tragedies in his life and overcoming and trying to, you know, approach the creative process in his own way. It's interesting. It's what we're seeking out. The other one I watched was I saw this documentary called Filmage. It's about the story of the Descendants, and the Descendants were a California power pop punk band to come out of the 80s and 90s. And I guess the best way to describe the Descendants would kind of be like almost like a punk rock, because they were really heavy on the harmony. You know the Descendants, Wendy?
Of course, yeah, all.
Yeah, yeah.
Milo Goes to College, all that, yeah.
Right. It's so funny that they were more of a, like, Morris, you would really love the Descendants because they're so hooky, like pop punk. Absolutely. I think you'd really love them, man.
I'm writing it down now.
The Descendants, actually, the band was based around a drummer, too, Bill Stevenson, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was a powerhouse. I mean, a bull. I mean, he played with, you know, the Descendants. He played with Black Flag. Eventually, he played with all, like, he played with so many different bands. But, I mean, it's a really, really solid documentary, too. I mean, I really quite enjoyed that. Music-wise, I just stumbled across something that really made my week that I thought was amazing. Is it's funny where you get into that juxtaposition where there's those bands that you wish would break up and they never do.
Yes.
And then there's those bands that you wish would get back together again and they never do. Or at least, but then once in a while.
A lot of makes no sense. Every band gets back together eventually, surely.
Well, not always, man. I mean, you
unless
know.
Unless they're all dead. Unless people are dead in the band.
Yeah.
You get one surviving member and he gets, you know, five session musos and he still calls the band by its original title. I'll think of one before we're out.
Right. But once in a while you get those bands that decide to come back after so many years, and it's either, you know, abysmally the screaming shits, or it turns out to be pretty amazing. And I had two really amazing surprises this week. One was first is the return of Swerve Driver.
Oh, huh.
And they've got a new album coming out, and it's really, really good. I mean, I've heard in advance of it, and it's really damn good. Their lead vocalist, man, he's a wicked songwriter, and like the new album is just fantastic. I really love it. Adam Franklin, that was just having a brain fart in the AM. No, it was Adam Franklin as their singer lyricist. Fantastic band. The other one that really blew my mind that Bernie would like is there was a band out of Texas, and they were, you know the trance label, Bernie.
Yes,
Trans Syndicate, right. Well,
you might say there's a bit of a connection,
right?
If you know,
they were very
might be, yeah. Carry on.
They were very like kind of a noisy punk rock based label for the Butthole Surfers.
Yeah.
King Coffee, the drummer of the Butthole Surfers, started that label. But they were focused on a lot of the noisier ends of the spectrum, you know, like bands like Ed Hall and the Pain Teens and, you know, that kind of thing. But anyways, there was a band that I really glommed onto in the early 90s that I loved called they're called the Cherubs. And
Yes, I've heard they've got some new stuff coming out, yes.
Yeah, they've got a new album coming out after 20 years. And, wow. You know, what's really funny is that you figure, you know, after 20 years, you kind of lose some of your piss and vinegar and your aggression or just your ability to just, you know, throw your balls into a blender, right? But, oh my God, man, like I just heard that new single and it was just like, oh, like the kids, this is how it's done. This is how it's done, you know? It's just so nice to see bands so many years later just still have that, like just that, you know, they're still have, they're, you know, it's like it just never went away, you know?
Wow. Probably is a good adjunct to both of those selections that you made there. I saw something on YouTube. I can't remember who made the post, but they had Bob Mould on the Letterman show, and he did
yeah.
songs from,
Beauty
and Ruin. And there's the Grant Hart connection, obviously. But what you just said there about showing the younger kids, this is how it's done. It was completely a case of that. Oh, my goodness. He had so much energy, so much piss and vinegar. And
apparently,
I haven't got that album yet, but I'm gunning for it now.
Apparently, with that live recording at the Letterman show, apparently dust was falling off the ceiling of the theater while they were playing. Like, yeah. But, I mean, you know, had any of you guys ever seen Sugar live?
Yes. And also, my band played a Halloween show as Sugar. We played all of Copper Blue one.
Oh, really?
with a band called the Husker Dudes.
Wow.
that was one of the best times of my life.
Seeing Bob Mould live, like, you know, I'd seen him in different incarnations. I mean, I'd seen him, you know, with Husker Du, and then I'd seen him on his first tour, solo tour, workbook tour. And then I'd seen him with Sugar. But that Sugar show, holy shit, that was one of the loudest shows, I'd say, next to the Swans that I've ever seen. I mean, like, I remember going out to take a piss during the show, and there was about half the audience sitting out in the lobby, and you could still hear it clear as a bell. I mean, people just, you couldn't, you know that feeling where you get it right in the solar plexus, like somebody starts poking a finger right in your midsection, you know? That's what it was for the whole show. And it was just the three of them, you know, like, I mean, just the trio. But, oh, my God, man, like, people come out of there, and it, you know, we used to joke. You know, I used to say that there was a headlining band, the Bees, and that everybody else opens up for the Bees, right? Because you know, you go home and you're still listening to the Bees because it's just like right, you got a hive full of hornets in your head, right? That's all. That's all you hear is. But Bob Mould, man, apparently that guy's got tinnitus. I mean, he's...
I was going to say, it's no wonder he suffers from that, is it, really?
Oh.
Poor Bob.
You know, one of my greatest months was, like, there was a two-week period. First of all, every time I've ever seen Grantheart solo, I feel really depressed. I feel really sad. I don't know. He bums me out. He bums me out so much because I love him so much. And it's usually just him doing a solo show playing electric guitar. Which, no offense, darling, but I want to see you play drums. That's why I'm, you know, maybe I'm a horrible person or just something. But, I mean, he's such a huge drumming influence. Like, I don't like seeing him just up there with an electric guitar playing these songs that I love him so much as a drummer for. But, so I went to go see Grantheart at a small club to, like, 9 people. And then the next week, I went to go see Bob Mould, like, playing this huge sold-out show.
Yeah.
And I was so depressed. What
you
mean.
Well, that's like, you know... I saw Grantheart with Nova Mob back in the 90s with Nova Mob and Run Westy Run. And I think, you know, everybody was sitting on the floor by the end of the night, like, you know, and it was just like, it was almost like a campfire sing-along thing, you know. And then after the show, they all wind up crashing at a friend's house and everyone sat around and played poker. We played cards. And
you
it was
played
just
cards
funny.
With Grantheart?
Yeah.
Oh, and my God.
We just sat around playing cards and shooting the shit. And it was
hey,
just
Wendy,
like,
was,
you know.
Wendy, they were playing strip poker.
But no, it was them and Run Westy Run, and it was just hilarious, you know. And yeah, and it's so funny because, you know, I just remember him talking about raising pumpkins in his backyard, you know, because he gave pumpkins to all the neighborhood kids and that he, you know, Uncle Grant was giving out the free pumpkins, right? And he was just talking about having a garden, really mundane shit. You know, just you're just a dude, you know. At the time, I was just kind of like, you know, man, you wrote so many fucking songs. Like, you know what I mean? And I'm just like, I can't even bring up any of that right now. Just shut your mouth. Don't say anything, man. It's just like, ears, open up. Mouth, stay shut. You know, like, don't say anything, you know.
Another one of the greatest nights of my life was Greg Norton came out for his birthday to see the Husker Dudes, our Husker Dude cover band. Not my Husker Du, but my friend's Husker Du cover band. And yeah, and he went up and he played with them. And he is just like the most good-natured person. Like, he is such a sweetheart. Greg Norton's amazing.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And apparently, he still has that mustache. He still has it. And he runs like a wine, like he runs his own winery now. He does like wine distribution. He has like a wine distribution company. Like, he's really doing well.
Yeah, he was running his own restaurant, I think, for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because he's a 5-star chef. I mean, that guy knows his shit. But yes. You know what's really funny? I'm not to go off on a little sidetrack, but like one of the funny things in the Grantheart documentary is that he's saying, you know, well, why didn't Greg Norton write more songs in Husker Du? He didn't write any songs. And apparently there was a deal between him, Grant, and Bob that, you know, Grant and Bob would write all the songs as long as he got to drive the van. He had to drive the van everywhere they went. But then Grant and Bob would write all the songs, and he'd drive the van, and that was it.
But obviously, I could talk all day about, like, Bob Mould's autobiography and that book about Husker Du that came out a couple years ago, where, like, they talked about how Bob and Grant, like, cut a deal with the studio where, like, they owned so much of a percentage of the equipment or something, and they screwed Greg out of, like, a lot of money that way. Like, there was just something weird... So many weird parts of the Husker Du story where, like, you're not sure who's really telling the truth, you know?
Absolutely.
I think you get three guys in a van together for a couple of years. a couple of years, and you just seem to get all sorts of weird passive-aggressive shit going on, don't you?
Yeah.
People rarely seem to come out of that unscathed, you know?
Well, especially when there's drugs involved and a potential love thing and all kind. And manager killed himself, and, you know, there's just... But I'm telling you, Greg Norton's an awesome person. You know, I feel like between him and Mike Watt, like, there just must be some sort of thing where, like, punk rock bass players are always the happiest members of the band. I don't know.
Oh, Watty's the man. Watty's the man. I love Watt. I love Watt.
We should do that Morris? Minutemen documentary sometime.
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know what else I thought about putting on the list? Maybe I should edit this out. But I was thinking, like, we haven't done any hip-hop movies. What about, like, one of those comedies, like CB4 or Fear of a Black Hat?
Fear of a Black Hat is fantastic.
We should definitely file that away for the future.
Yeah. Bernie?
Yeah, it's me, isn't it? Okay. Well, two things, quickly. A movie I saw last week from 1959 called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. You guys heard of this?
No.
Stars Harry Belafonte, so there is a slight musical connection. And it's this bizarre kind of end-of-the-world type thing. Harry Belafonte is a miner, and he's trapped underground when a nuclear attack happens. He manages to sort of scrabble his way back up several days later and makes his way to New York. And it's just deserted. So he's on his own, trying to piece his life back together. And then Inger Stevens shows up. Another, as far as I can tell, the only two survivors. And so they kind of develop this strange relationship. But then, Mel Ferrer, who I believe is Miguel's dad. He shows up, and so you've got this kind of weird triangle going on, and the kind of racial aspect comes into it because, you know, Inger wants to be with Harry, but, you know, conventions back in the 50s still, it was a little frowned upon. So yeah, I don't know, it's a really interesting movie. Some of the dialogue actually is a little bit clunky, and it comes from a sort of novel. I don't know whether that's down to the original writer or screenwriter or what, but it's full of some really interesting ideas. It's beautifully shot. God knows how they got these huge swathes of New York completely deserted with just Harry Belafonte running down the middle of the street, you know?
So are we saying this is the Omega Man starring Harry Belafonte?
I was just thinking Omega Man.
Kind of, yeah. No vampires, though. It's just, you know, it's a man-made thing.
There's that shot 28 Days Later in the beginning with the highway, the empty highway, and They only had 5 minutes, or so to get that one shot. So, like, you know, like when you say how can they clear everything out, it's probably like right at the crack of dawn at 5 a.m. when, you know, all this shit's going. Yeah.
But it's an interesting film that I'd never heard of up until a little while ago, to be honest. And Harry Belafonte's, you know, he was a good actor. I've seen him in a few pictures, movies, and I think he's pretty underrated as an actor. So there you go. It's worth checking out. Interesting. And I will quickly mention an LP, which has totally kicked my ass. I came across it about a week ago. Now, it's by two guys, a guy called Patrick Cowley and a guy called, probably going to pronounce this incorrectly, Jorge? How would you pronounce that with the J?
Jorge.
There you go. Jorge.
You don't have any horses, do you?
No, Jorge's any. I've never met a Jorge. I've never even spoken about a Jorge before. But Patrick Cowley and Jorge Soroka, I believe he was called. Now, Patrick Cowley was a dude who sort of studied electronic music at a music school in San Francisco, went on to become a big part of the kind of gay club scene. He actually produced You Make Me Feel Mighty Real by Sylvester.
Oh, I remember that.
And he's generally regarded as one of the sort of founders of the whole sort of high energy type thing, which was, you know, obviously the kind of gay disco thing that was prevalent back then in the early 80s. But from about 1976 through to about 1980, he recorded intermittently with this guy, Jorge. And it's freaking amazing. It's like, if you can imagine Suicide jamming with the Ramones in like one of the clubs that Al Pacino goes to in Cruising, just absolutely insane. Real, like, so dumb, their profound lyrics about like watching TV and wearing leather jackets and stuff like that. But a real kind of weird electronic synthy kind of swooshes and then like real Ramones sort of Ramalama kind of stuff. But yeah, this LP, it's a compilation of that stuff and it's called Catholic. And it was reissued a few years ago, I believe, on, I think, the Dark Entries label, something like that, who do a lot of early 80s synthy stuff. But it's freaking awesome. It's really good.
I was going to say, is it kind of in the same ballpark, like early Killing Joke type stuff?
No, it's a lot more kind of synthy and dancey and very much coming from a sort of electronic sort of point of view.
No, I was going to say, it's just that, like you were saying, like the dancey, but then the heavier end of things, because I was saying, you know, how Killing Joke mixed kind of like, you know, that tribal punky stuff with almost like disco.
Yeah, no, this Patrick Cowley was coming more from a sort of disco point of view. So it's got that sort of, you know, kind of electronic disco feel. But with, I mean, this stuff in particular, this Catholic album, just, I don't actually think there's any guitars on there at all, but it's just kind of the songwriting, the lyrics, and particularly Jorge's delivery. He's kind of like a, you know, a kind of weird, twisted take on Joey Ramone, although Joey Ramone was pretty weird and twisted anyway. But Patrick Cowley also did an LP which was reissued a while ago called School Days, which was incidental music, which he made for a studio that was making gay porn videos in the early 80s. And that is just, again, it's kind of crazy. It's like, you know, Tangerine Dream scoring gay porn. It's, what the hell's going on? But it's great. It's really worth checking out. And unfortunately, he died very young. He died in 82. 32 years old, he was one of the sort of early victims of the AIDS epidemic. So he was misdiagnosed because people just didn't know, still at that point, didn't know what it was and what was going on. So he died super young, but kind of left this back catalogue of amazing music, which is only really now, I think, people are beginning to pick up on. So Patrick Cowley, look him up and check out some of his stuff, because very interesting guy and very interesting music. Makes me want to shake my booty. Doesn't happen very often, so there you go. That's my choices this month.
Yay! Oh man, I saw a bunch of movies recently. I went to the theater for one day, and I saw both Paddington and The Boy Next Door.
Paddington is amazing, isn't it?
Paddington was way better than people would expect it to be. I enjoyed the hell out of it. It was great. I felt like a lot of the little visual storytelling things were very sort of Wes Anderson-y, like the design of the house and the way they would do, like, frame, you know, scenes and stuff. I thought that was really neat. I'm going to come out and say that I enjoyed Paddington. I think it was a great movie.
I think it's almost the perfect family movie. I couldn't fault it at all. It's you know... There's enough peril in there for kids, and there's enough sort of in-jokes for adults, and it's just a really fun, nicely done, heartwarming movie that wasn't too kind of sappy and sentimental, you know, so...
Right, and I loved the whole, you know, all the opening of it in Peru, like all the scenes in Peru with the design of, like, the treehouse and all these things.
Yeah. No, good stuff. Oh, good, I'm glad you liked it, Wendy. That's awesome.
Yes, yeah, as a diehard childhood Paddington lover, you know, I really enjoyed it, so. And then, but, like, SpongeBob SquarePants is, like, dominating the box office this week, and I'm like, how the fuck is that doing better than Paddington? Like, that's ridiculous to me. I don't know. But
people have no taste.
We're Americans, what the hell, you know, I'm sure people don't know who the fuck Paddington Bear is, you know. Last night I was getting one of my comic friends to draw me a mashup of Paddington and the Punisher, so Punisherington.
Nice, in a blue duffel coat with a floppy hat and
skull exactly. On the front. Because I was trying to think, like, who's the comic character who wears, like, a coat that you can make look like Paddington, you know? I was trying to think of that. But yeah, and what else? Oh, I saw Birdman recently.
Mm.
And,
so we were a fan of Antonio Sanchez's drum score.
I liked it. I liked the drum score a lot. Look, but
see, I'm with you. I really, really loved it. And I'm a huge fan of Antonio Sanchez anyways, Pat Metheny's drummer. But
that's who he is. All right.
Yeah. I saw Pat Metheny back in October. And as much as I'm a huge fan of Metheny, Antonio Sanchez was for me the highlight of the band, and they're all absolutely brilliant musicians. Yeah, actually, I really thought that drum score worked a treat for that film, and yet I can't remember who it was, but someone on the GGTMC group said that it drove them nuts. But yeah, for me, that was absolutely, for me, it was a highlight.
I preferred the score over, like, all the fancy camera work stuff. I really, the score might have been my favorite part of the movie, you know, but.
I'm with you, actually, Wendy. I think the movie's overrated, but the score was excellent. Yeah.
I can't say that very loud. I can't say it very loud.
I can't remember if I spoke about this with Tim yesterday, and maybe I spoke about it with you, Bernie, as well a week ago. My position on Birdman is it sort of reminds me a lot of those Charlie Kaufman films of the late 90s, early noughties. And, you know, really, really, really clever. But for me, the Kaufman film that I always come back to is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, because it's so clever and it has heart. Whereas the others, they're very clever, but the emotion of Sunshine that keeps drawing me back. And I think that Birdman could have been great if the emotional side, which they were working towards, but it just doesn't really get you there. So what you're left with is how clever it looks rather than how there's an emotional core that's at the center of it.
Well, I was having the conversation, I think it was Jason Wedgwood and I were talking, and we both decided it was like, it's like Noises Off. You know, like, you remember that movie Noises Off about the Broadway production? It's a lot like that, only with a washed up superhero guy, you know, or it's kind of like Bolts Over Broadway, only with a washed up superhero guy. It's kind of, I just felt like, oh yeah, I feel as though I've seen this like, oh, crazy Broadway production gone awry. I feel like, anyway, yeah, like I feel as though there are just a lot of movies, and Birdman is kind of one of them, where like halfway through the movie, you're like, somebody's got to fucking kill themselves already. That's going to happen. Somebody just fucking do this already. You know? I just feel like there are just certain movies where I'm just waiting and waiting. It's like, oh, somebody's going to die at some point. Just let it happen soon.
There's several points in Birdman where people have sat on ledges quite high up on top of buildings, and I was fully expecting someone to just, you know, go over the side.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just like, somebody just jump. Happen, like... Push Edward Norton off.
Edward Norton was great, but I think he was just playing himself, wasn't he? I don't think that was much of a stretch for him at all.
Yeah. Also, I watched a Western recently called The Salvation, and it stars Mads Mikkelsen and Eva Green and Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Yeah, I've heard about this. I thought this sounded quite interesting. What's it like?
It's very good. It's very good. Like, Mads Mikkelsen is a Danish settler, and you know, of course, things happen, and he has to go on a course of revenge. And Jeffrey Dean Morgan is the main bad guy, and he's just very sinister. Eva Green is mute, like she's the mute wife of this, you know, this one bad guy, and she's, of course, she's spectacular and very menacing in her own way, the way she always is. So I enjoyed it. I think Salvation is very good.
Excellent. I'm gonna check that one out.
All right. So shall we take a break and then come back and we'll discuss Alison Anders' Grace of My Heart.
Living in another world.
You've been at this a while, huh? Lady singers, they just don't sell. Male vocal groups, that's the ticket these days.
You know, I wrote it.
It's very nice to hear.
Thank you.
It really is.
Listen, the song is yours, guys.
What you wrote here, beautiful.
Denise, we need a B-side. What else you got?
B-side.
The voice behind their power is Denise Waverly.
I talked to Redbird today. They'll sign you for one single.
I don't have a song to sing.
So write something. Isn't that what I pay you for?
So God, give me strength. God, give me strength.
I would know the first thing about how to save even myself with a song, much less the world.
You're the best songwriter in this joke of a business.
I think we should try to make it big.
You were holding out on me. Why did you save your best song for girls?
I'm a singer, and I'm going to record my own stuff.
Welcome back to See Here. And so this time around, it was my pick. And so I chose the film Grace of My Heart from, what year was this from? Do we know offhand?
1996.
With Alison Anders directing, starring Ileana Douglas, John Turturro, Eric Stoltz, Matt Dillon. It's got a big cast.
I was going to mention there, Wendy, because I think it came out either just before or just after another film that we've discussed, albeit for Silver and Gold, That Thing You Do.
Yes, yes. And there, it has a couple similarities with That Thing You Do. You know, so yeah, I love both these movies, if I may play my hand in advance. But.
Spoiler alert, Wendy loves it.
Okay, see you next time, everyone.
Bye-bye. Well, hang on, we haven't shown our hands yet, so.
Yeah, no, you guys are so
I love it too. Oh, giving it away.
I know, I always wear my heart on my sleeve on these things.
Right.
So, anyway, right. Somebody else, give us a synopsis.
Alright. Yeah. Okay, so very simply, this is not from IMDb, just a few notes I've put together. It's basically, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's the journey of a woman born into a wealthy family with a strict matriarch. I won't put on that silver and gold voice. yeah, so story of a woman played by Ileana Douglas, who's born into a wealthy family. I think what they run a steel mill or something like that. And she wants to make it as a singer-songwriter, starting in the pre-Beatles era when you just didn't do both. And the story basically covers about 10 years or so in her life, covering changing hairstyles, clothes, the men in her life. But strangely enough, the changes in music styles and counterculture are not really as heavily emphasized as you would have thought. But basically, it's about her journey and the people in her life.
Yeah, it's the thinly veiled story of Carole King.
Well, you see,
allegedly.
See, that's something I wanted to ask, because, I mean, apart from the obvious stuff of Carole King working in the Brill Building with, you know, Jerry Goffin, I don't really know that much about her biographical details. But one thing I'm pretty sure is that Carole King never got married to Brian Wilson. So one thing about this film is it sort of like says, well, look, we'll take this character, and this woman's sort of a little bit like Carole King, and we're going to take this guy, and he's sort of a little bit like Brian Wilson, and we're going to take
Turturro, just sort of a little bit like Phil Spector. Yeah.
But they mentioned Phil Spector by name in the film.
Yeah.
So it's a bit all over the place in that regard. But anyway, so
I thought too that she reminded me a little bit of Carly Simon.
Yeah, that's that too.
So yeah, the story does tend to sort of, you know, cover bits and pieces of the ground. I wouldn't say it's like a biography of anyone, but it's inspired by several stories, and it's sort of like a,
you know,
the original mashup.
You know what it reminds me of is, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but it reminded me of an Altman film like Nashville a little bit, where, you know, you just get a whole kind of pastiche, a mixture of all these different characters. And you've got, you know, the one primary character through the whole gist of it, but it's like all these people kind of fall in and disappear and fall in and disappear.
Right.
And, you know, and with Altman, you know, it's like you get people, the characters that remind you of real people, but they're not those people.
Yeah.
You know, there's kind of, you know, little tinges of, you know, kind of they, you know, Altman kind of is really kind of ambiguous about, you know, who he's trying to say this certain character is. You know, he won't come right out and say it.
And isn't that more fascinating than having a straight up biopic? At the end of the day, isn't that what?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that's what this film is to me.
I think one of this film's main strengths is that the way that it kind of plays with fact and fiction, and her story kind of weaves in and out of truth and untruth. It just works really well, and I think it gives them bigger scope to cover, you know, a longer period and perhaps a broader musical kind of remit.
Well, I'm going to throw my hand in here and say that I'm generally actually, whilst there's things in here that I do like, and you'd have to be like a real grumpy guts to not find anything in here to like, I have quite a few problems with it, and I think that the main gist, when we had a discussion a few months back about Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, I think that even though this is strictly not a biographical film, but it follows a lot of the same tropes, you know, your characters who do come in, come out, and everything is ticked off, right? We're going to talk about this character in her life, and or we're going to talk about that character in her life, and it's more like a group of vignettes, and if the main character, Edna Buxton / Denise Waverley, were real, at the end of it, the directors would say, right, well, now you know her life, even though we're telling it to you through a bunch of hearsay and stories and vignettes in her life. So even though it's not strictly speaking a biography, it's run the same way as some of the more recent Hollywood biopics like Walk the Line and Ray, and for that matter, it looks like Walk Hard was taking the Mickey out of films just like this.
Yeah. Now, can we talk about Ileana Douglas, like as a person and actress? I don't understand why Ileana Douglas hasn't had a bigger career. Like, I love her to death. I feel like she's very unconventional looking. I feel like she's like the modern equivalent of actresses like Sissy Spacek or Shelley Duvall. I feel like she's so like odd looking, and you know, I just, I don't know, she's very attractive to me. I adore her, but
You know what? From an acting perspective, there is no one in this film that fails me. Ileana Douglas is absolutely fantastic. I've seen her in a couple of other things. I think, you know, my wife's a huge fan of the HBO series 6 Feet Under, and I mean, whilst I didn't watch every episode, I'd watch it from time to time, and she was in that, and you know, playing her quirky sort of character sort of thing in there.
What was the Nicole Kidman film where Nicole Kidman killed her husband and Ileana Douglas was like the sister-in-law who figures her out?
Was it To Die For?
Yeah, To Die For.
Gus Van Zandt.
She was the weather presenter, yeah. Wasn't she? Nicole Kidman, yeah.
Yeah. I like her in that too.
And isn't Ileana Douglas, she's in, is it Stir of Echoes as well? The Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
Ghost flick. I remember that being pretty enjoyable, and she was pretty good in that.
Oh, in Ghost World. Yeah. Remember she was like the hilarious, like the crazy art teacher in Ghost World?
Yes!
Yeah. Oh,
that's right. Yeah.
Tampon in the teacup. That was her. She was the tampon in the teacup.
I don't know if you've seen this, Wendy, but I'd listened to an interview with Ileana Douglas. I think it might have been on the Projection Booth podcast, and they were talking about a web series that she'd put together. It's strange. I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically, it looks like it's been sponsored and paid for by IKEA, and it's these 6 or 7 minute little stories that she's basically playing a version of herself, and she wants to leave Hollywood, and she doesn't want to make films anymore. She just wants to work in IKEA, sort of being as that person who walks around the store and greets you and uses her entertainment skills in the IKEA store. Damn, I wish I could remember the name of this, but I watched a couple of episodes.
I would watch the hell out of this.
She produces this. This is her baby. It's an Ileana Douglas production. And it's not the sort of thing which they've done about three, four seasons of this, and she's won awards for it. They've got all sorts of famous Hollywood people making cameos in it. And it's really the strangest thing out. Now, I wouldn't say it's completely altogether successful, given that it's actually paid for by IKEA. But you should. I'll send you a note. I'll put a note up on the page when I remember what it's actually called.
Can we find this on YouTube or something, Morris?
Yes. It's all on YouTube. The whole thing is on YouTube.
Is this like the
Ileana? Sounds amazing.
Hang on a sec. Keep talking. I'll find out what the name is now. Hang on.
Is this like the Ileana Douglas IKEA version of those like Clive Owen BMW movies? Is that what this is?
Easy to assemble. It's called Easy to Assemble. There you go.
What else could it be called? Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which IKEA products never are, but you know.
It's very strange. I mean, I would have felt. I've watched about 2-3 episodes, and I think it would have been probably easier to take if it wasn't done with IKEA's approval, but you know, they had to film it scenes of it in an IKEA store, so obviously it's going to take their approval. It would have been a little bit more twisted, a little bit darker maybe, but otherwise it's worth a watch. So yeah, that's another Renault cap.
I bet if you go round to Ileana Douglas's house, if she invites you round for dinner and you go round and it's just like IKEA shit everywhere. All her couches and shelving and her dinner table and like all the saucepans and stuff she'll cook dinner for you in.
Yes, yeah, so we'll all get IKEA. To eat on her Bjork table or her, you know, Norsky bookcase or whatever.
Right.
And she serves you coffee and those little vanilla biscuits that you get from IKEA at the end.
The Swedish meatballs, the frozen lingonberries.
Yeah.
Oh, they make
the main course.
Swedish meatballs in this show, so. But I agree that she does do a terrific job in Grace of My Heart, and she does this strange combination of being vulnerable and yet wanting to try and be strong. You know, she's not being overly forceful, but you know, I guess that is something that's authentic with the time. You know, if her character was based in the 90s. Then she'd probably say, I'm standing up for myself. You men can't tell me how to produce this record. I'm going to do the record how I want. But that was not the way that, you know, she could do in late 1959, early 1960 or whatever. She had to take what she could get and she had to bide her time, but she still had enough strength, to be able to sort of persist with her muse. And there's this great scene where, her husband in the first part of the film played by Eric Stoltz, who I think would have probably been even better served if it had been played by Steve Zahn. But there's a bit where they're in a radio studio and they're talking about a song that they're writing, or maybe they've just written, about a girl who gets a teenage girl who gets pregnant.
Unwanted and, number.
That's the one. Yeah. And the Eric Stoltz character keeps saying, "Oh, well, it really needs to be told from the boyfriend's perspective." And she's saying, no, I think this needs to be done from the pregnant girl's perspective." And she's not being, you know, sort of like overly forceful, but she's standing up for herself in a way that seems realistic with the time. So I admired that aspect of the writing, and I certainly admired that aspect of Eliana Douglas's acting. It was not going over the top. It was just, she did what had to be done, and I think she did a fantastic job.
You know, another thing I really, really appreciate about this movie, as you know, a majority of the movies I generally like could be considered macho, I suppose. And so this is what, like, I really enjoyed the fact that, like, they set it up, her relationships with other women. They introduced them as though they could be rivalries, like her friendship with Doris, the woman who she meets in the first few moments. Like, she's entered a singing competition against this woman, and they set it up as though, like, oh, well, she's going to be this big competition to her. And no, instead they turn out to be lifelong friends. And the same thing with Patsy Kensit, like the blonde British, you know, with another appearance by Chris Isaac. You know, Chris Isaac popping up all the time. But yeah, like, they set it up, they establish it quickly, like, oh, this woman's going to be her rival, and then they end up becoming friends. Like, I liked that a lot. I liked that aspect of legitimate, like, female friendship.
Yeah, no, I completely can see that. And she's, I think, though, in general, she's the sort of character who wants to see the best in everyone. And, you know, I mean, like, even, you know, the men in her life, she wants to try and believe in them, but it seems to be the women who, yeah, you're right, she could have had this rivalry on, but she doesn't want to antagonize. She doesn't want to butt heads. And they find that way. And, her character is a good character. She's a positive character. She's just trying to break out of her mother's, domination, I guess.
But even that, it's like she breaks out of her mother's domination, but then she has to break out from her husband's, you know, and, but yeah, it was great because she was always looking for, like, a way to work in her friend Doris or a way to work in her other... She was always looking to get her friend's gigs.
Right.
So what do we have to say about the soundtrack? The soundtrack, I remember, being a big deal because it teamed up, like, 90s indie rockers of that time with classic songwriters.
You know what? This is the first time, because it's been a long time since I watched the film, but going back over the credits and it said that the Riptides were played by Red Cross.
Yes, they're in the movie! Yeah, the McDonald brothers. I was so happy.
Holy moly.
And also Kim Gordon does the voice. Like, you can hear Kim Gordon singing whatever that song with the girls on the...
Trouble Girl, doesn't she?
Right, yeah, that's her. Yeah, and then I noticed, oh yeah, Sean Colvin is in the movie, and Jill Sobule's in the movie.
Jay,
like,
Maskus is in there as well.
Right, yeah, it was so much, it's so funny, because it's such a weird 90s, it's a 90s time capsule as much as it's a 60s time capsule, you know?
Yeah. And was it Larry Klein, who produced a lot of the songs and co-wrote some of the songs? And, you know, so that meant that there was access to Joni Mitchell, so, you know, Joni Mitchell wrote something. I think the song In Another World was co-written by Jerry Goffin with, I'm not sure if it's David Hidalgo or someone from Los Lobos, probably Hidalgo. Just to get Jerry Goffin's involvement in this film, holy moly. So, but of course.
I think it speaks volumes for the film as well, that, you know, they did the homework and they got the correct people. You know, particularly for the soundtrack to contribute, because if it was just a bunch of people doing pastiches of this or trying to write this kind of stuff, and the fact that you've got, you know, a lineage of people who, you know, who were there at the time, actually contributing to the soundtrack, it gives it that kind of, you know, because quite often when you see films like this and you have a soundtrack where people are writing songs which are supposed to sound like something, but it's not quite that because they couldn't get the rights or the right people, that I think that could really take you out of it. But they get it spot on in this, I think.
Yeah, look, I think Wendy and Tim and I had spoken about this on Silver and Gold when we talked about That Thing You Do, and that was a film where, apart from obviously, you know, the title song, which had been written by Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne, I think mostly the songs, which might have been written by Tom Hanks himself, they got it so wrong. It's like, right, let's work to a style, but the song itself doesn't have to be particularly memorable. Whereas I think that, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm going to go out and get the soundtrack album of this, but the songs by and large do tend to work a whole lot better. But I've lost count of how many times I've listened to God Give Me Strength. And this is even at a time before I could count myself as being an admirer of Burt Bacharach. It's only been maybe the last 10 years where I've sort of come around to acknowledging just how strong an arranger and melody writer Bacharach actually is and has been. But by and large, I think that the songs do actually sort of work in this film.
It's funny because I have such admiration for that whole Brill Building period. I don't know, I love the idea of just pop songwriting as a business, as just like you lock yourself in with a piano and a partner and that's it, you're just going to churn out songs. I find something so weirdly admirable about that. It's the most corporate version of doing anything. It's the most, like, anti-artistic way, but I love that.
But, look, you know what? I understand that. That makes sense to me because I can understand if someone says, oh, look, a melody popped into my head and I quickly wrote it down, but I've never sort of gone down the John Lennon school of thinking, which says, oh, there are melodies, they're all flying through the air, and sometimes we just have to reach out and grab them.
The Matt Dillon, like, that's so much, I thought it did such a great job differentiating between, like, the Eric Stoltz character and the Matt Dillon character. That's how Brian Wilson, like, when they're showing the interview with him, he's just like, yeah, go on, Tim.
What, was it just me, or, like, I felt that Matt Dillon, you know, they totally miscast him for that role. Because, I don't know, he just felt so, like, him wearing kind of a wig and just like, you know, really, really, can you dig that? Can you dig what we're trying to do? Like, and I'm like, it just didn't work for me. I don't know. Like, he was trying to channel Keanu, I think, and it just wasn't working for him. I don't know. Like, I just felt like he was miscast.
Yeah, that's the only part of the film that falls flat for me. It's like, oh god, I wish they could have cut like some of that bullshit with the guru guy. So I'm like, oh, I wish they could have cut that.
Look,
if it was a different actor, maybe I could have accepted it more. But I don't know. With Matt Dillon, it was just like, ugh.
Is it because
I was going to say, is it because it was obviously Brian Wilson, and you know Matt Dillon looks about as far away from Brian Wilson as you can possibly get.
Right.
So
who would I cast as Brian Wilson?
Yeah, who would be your pick, Brian Wilson?
Well, they're making a Brian Wilson, or is it Beach Boys, a narrative film at the moment? I can't remember who's in it, but that sometime this year it's coming out.
I would say for vulnerability and just for the quirkiness and everything, I would have to go with Crispin Glover.
I had a feeling you were going to say that. I don't know why.
It's funny because I was just thinking Jeremy Davies.
Yeah.
Crispin Glover
has that kind of,
you know, Idris Elba. Yeah. Why can't we make Brian Wilson black? Come on.
Yeah. Right.
Look, one of the things that I think you've gone and sort of put the onus there, Tim, on Matt Dillon and his acting performance, but I just sort of found it, there were parts of this film that were trying to be like the Wonder Years. You know, it was like they're playing on their audience's sense of, well, you weren't there in the 60s, but take our word for it, this is what it was like. And if you've watched the Wonder Years, then you know that what we're saying is true. And we're going to play on all the cliches, and we're going to have a character who says, man, a lot, and can you dig it? And we're going to play on the myth and the ethos of Phil Spector. And I guess, as I said before, I loved a lot of the acting, but they were playing on character stereotypes. I mean, Ileana Douglas's character was pretty well rounded, but John Turturro, and I love John Turturro, and I think he did a fantastic job with what the hand he was dealt here. But, you know, come on, he was playing this horrible stereotype, and Matt Dillon was playing.
Isn't it difficult to make a film like this about this kind of subject matter without bowing to those stereotypes? Because you know, there's a history there, and this stuff is so ingrained in culture, like musical culture. It's well, I mean, is there a way around that?
Look, you know what? I'm a terrible storyteller, and that's why I'll never be a filmmaker. So I probably can't. I can't think of how they do it, but I just sort of found myself watching this and thinking, oh, really? Oh, really? But, I mean, look, okay, it's still to Alison Anders' credit and the actor's credit that I could watch the film for 2 hours and still come away. I picked faults in it, and yet I'd say, all right, this was still worth the rewatch. And you know, Turturro is good. I don't think I've ever seen a bad Turturro performance.
That's true.
But yeah, look, he was told, like, you know, go play the stereotypical Jewish manager, and well, I'm a nice Hebrew boy, but I'm also partly Italian.
Just like Walk Hard. He was just like the Jewish managers of Walk Hard.
in what?
Walk Hard. Remember, there was like the
Jewish. Oh, yeah. No, I wasn't meaning to sound like him, but go on.
I was going to say something that here, going back to what we were talking about earlier, is that, you know, when you don't want to specify who these people are, in the terms of history, and you're trying to be, you know, kind of gloss it over and be a bit ambiguous. But at the same time, in order to be ambiguous, you kind of have to focus on certain tropes.
Yeah, look, I acknowledge that. And I, as I said a minute ago, I probably struggle to think on how I would do it differently. And yet, sort of watching this, I'm thinking that they sort of didn't really know quite what was the best way to do it. They thought, right, well, okay, we can't afford the rights to do a story about Carole King and Jerry Goffin, because the copyrights for the actual songs would be way too much. So what we have to do is make up our own story, and nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we'll allude to the fact that it's Carole King. Hey, why don't we bring Brian Wilson in? And hey, why don't we bring Phil Spector? And why don't we do all this and make a bit of a mashup? And it just didn't seem satisfactory. And it probably, okay, worked out better than a straight out Carole King biopic might have been. And right. Yeah, you're right.
Although there is one on Broadway right now. There is a Carole King biopic Broadway musical right now that uses all of her songs that I would love to see.
Oh, well.
But but the thing that I love so much about Turturro is, I mean, obviously if we were making a movie about Phil Spector, he would have been batshit insane. But Turturro was like the best friend. Like, he could have easily been like the hard-ass manager. He could have been a dick, but he actually fostered her career and really wanted her to do that solo song, and to do, you know, like, he was always encouraging. And then, like, I love the scene when she's kind of giving up on life and they're in that shitty commune, and he comes and he rescues her from the commune. Like, I love that. He was a friend.
That scene where they're sat with the swimming pool and, you know, they're screaming at each other, and the camera just goes right into them whilst they're shouting, and then they're embracing and crying, and it just kind of pulls out again. I thought that was really nicely done.
That's one scene, like in the last third of the movie, that completely pulled me in. Turturro should have been nominated for some award for that.
That I loved so much was the scene where they're in the club and Turturro's introducing her to Eric Stoltz, and they're all just like dancing, and they're all being manic, and they're all being goofy, and like, I thought that was just like such a fun way of framing a scene. That was just such a fun way of propelling the action in it, you know.
Turturro can twist with the best of them, can he? He was going for it there. He really was.
I wonder if there was any influence from the nightclub scene in A Hard Day's Night. I wonder if they were sort of like looking towards that, because it sort of reminded me a little bit of that.
Now, what about the Bruce Davison character, the DJ guy? Like, it struck me as it was so funny to me. I felt like he was so much older than her, but I guess like he kind of needed to be, since he was sort of that grounded, mature character in the movie, but
right. I mean,
his role was
But go on.
So I was going to say his role was a little slight. He was just there to kind of serve that purpose more than, he wasn't a particularly well-defined or developed character. He was just like, you know, the older and more mature guy who represented everything that the Eric Stoltz character didn't.
Mm-hmm.
For her to, to fall in love with. And then, have a little bit more heartbreak so she could write a few more songs about it. So, yeah, I think he, it wasn't badly handled. There just wasn't much there to handle with him.
Mm. I guess that's the sort of thing, we should be sort of thankful that the film just runs at 2 hours, and yet they potentially have enough material there to make either a longer film or even like a, two-hour TV movies or something like that, two-part.
But I just, I spotted on IMDb just now, apparently, Boyd Rice, you aware who Boyd Rice is?
Oh, yeah, uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Apparently, he was in this, playing a Lee Hazelwood-type character, but all that stuff was cut out, apparently. So can you imagine that? That's just a crazy casting. That's really bizarre, isn't it?
Well, I know he's good friends with Al Ellis.
Yeah, well, it makes sense, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, had any of you seen the other things from Alison Anders, like Gas Food Lodging, or?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Or
yeah. I was about to say that I think that, from my perspective, I've always seen her films as kind of a real. She had this stint on in through most of her films. I mean, most of her films, she really goes out of her way to present really strong women, and women that come through, hell and back in different ways, or just the exploration of women finding themselves, empowerment. I find that the majority of her films kind of portray that, at least for me, that's what I get out of them.
Yeah, so it's not often you get these strong portrayals of women's friendships.
Right.
So now you're going to tell us a story about the version of God Give Me Strength that is not on the soundtrack.
Not so much about the song itself, but we were speaking off air earlier on about the scene in which Ileana Douglas's character, she finally gets a chance after being told for many years that she only can write for other performers, and she finally gets this chance to record a single for herself, and unfortunately goes out and it flops. But we see there's a scene in the film, maybe it's the most famous scene in the film, where she's performing God Give Me Strength, and there's a piano player who's performing, and Ileana Douglas is standing at the microphone, and she's wearing a crop top, and she's jogging up and down on foot to foot and moving from side to side. Sorry, say that again.
It drove me nuts. All I could think is like, you're it's not going to sound good in the recording. Stand still.
Well, here's the thing, actually, Wendy. I was listening, as I mentioned earlier on, to a podcast. Okay, so there was, we got one, I think the projection booth, they interviewed Ileana Douglas. But I'm trying to think, there was another podcast where they spoke with Alison Anders. I can't remember which one it was. That wasn't it. It was a typed interview with Alison Anders done by, I think, Justin Bozung. And, it was either in that one or the Ileana Douglas one where they said that, in fact, Ileana Douglas she watched Kirsten Vergaard, who does her voice, her singing voice for the film. She watched her in the recording studio sing God Give Me Strength because they recorded all the songs before they actually acted to them in the film, which I would have thought they would have done the other way around. And she said that she was basically copying what Kirsten Vergaard did while she was recording the song. So, in fact, that's what Kirsten had done while she was recording the song. Thinking, well, right, it's good enough for her, then that's what I'll do. She was taking inspiration, thinking, right, if it's good enough for a recording star to do that, then I might as well do that. So that's actually based on what she'd seen. And it's interesting because they had performers in this film, like Douglas herself, and allegedly Matt Dillon can also sing. And I know that Ileana Douglas, she is apparently a I don't know if she's an accomplished musician, but she does play the ukulele, and she's performed live at some big multi-thousand ukulele concert conference or something like that in New York. But she actually is a singer, so she was always really sort of confused. She made the best of what they ended up doing, but she could have sung that bit herself. But in the end, they got Kirsten Vergaard. Now, I can't remember what else Kirsten is overdubbed voices for, but she's, I don't know if she's ever like acted in a film or we've seen her acting in a film, but she's a voiceover girl. So anyway, yeah, that was based on my story. Move on.
And yet the Kirsten Vergaard version is not available on the soundtrack.
Right, right, which I think Alison Anders had said in this interview she continuously regretted. So I don't know what there was the story with that, whether there was only whether there were performance rights or some sort of weird shit. I mean, look, yeah, personally, I love the Elvis Costello Burt Bacharach version, but there's a strength and power and vulnerability all at once in the version that we hear in the film, just the piano and her voice, and man, I could quite happily listen to that over and over and over again. She does an absolutely beautiful job.
So not particularly related to what you were talking about there, Morris, but I'm just on IMDb here.
Oh, yeah.
Looking on the recent posts on the message board, one of them is Bridget Fonda's character a lesbian?
That was also a very entertaining segment. Once again, I liked it was interesting about how you know Ileana Douglas drew such inspiration to write these songs for people from things that were happening to them rather than her own experiences. You know, but yeah,
she was writing them for the people, wasn't she? Based on their lives, yeah.
But yeah, it's like Bridget Fonda's just a goody-goody who is on some like TV show and making an album or something, but she's really a lesbian, and they write a song about it. I thought that was really charming. I thought that was pretty funny.
I was going to ask, just coming back to Alison Anders, we were speaking about her before and what we'd gone and watched of her other films. Do you think that this is her strongest work, or do you think Tim's gone and mentioned already, you know, big fan of Gas Food Lodging and her not Gas Food Lodging. I did say Gas Food. Sorry.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, it was Gas Food Lodging. Yeah.
So it's, anyway, sorry, get mixed up.
Mi Vida Loca was another one too.
Yeah, Bernice really likes that one.
Mm.
It's funny, but we first met, that was, she owned about 10 sell through video cassettes, that was one of them. She sat, made me sit down and watch it.
Huh?
Yeah, it's a good one.
So what else did she do?
Her episodes of Sex and the City were some of the best as well, I do have to say.
I have to say that I think it's her. It was her episode in Four Rooms. Was that the one with Madonna and the witches? Was that her? Or was that Alexandra Rockwell?
I can't even remember, to be honest.
I'm pretty sure it was Alison Anders, and that was, for me, the weakest point of the film. And I think it was at that point where I sort of thought, oh, no, she's Alison Anders has left the room, because I love Gas Food Lodging.
Well, what has she done? Has she done anything recently? I'm going to look this up now.
Okay.
She's done a lot of TV stuff, Wendy. Pretty much every, what's she done? Sex and the City, Cold Case, The L Word. What About Brian?
Well, it's interesting. Okay, so like,
Southland, she did The Mentalist. She's worked on Orange is the New Black. An awful lot of TV in the last sort of 10 years or so, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. Well, isn't that, I remember reading something about like how that's what a lot of female directors have done. You know, like, and especially you see, like, Diane Keaton has directed a lot of, you see a lot of women who have taken to directing TV shows. And I wonder if that's because, is it just easier, is it harder to get funding in movies now? Is it harder to get attention? I don't know. I find that interesting. But
it looks like with a lot of the HBO shows and
I'm guessing a lot with the other cable network shows, that they have maybe a core group of directors. I mean, like, you know, while watching The Sopranos or 6 Feet Under or any of those other sort of programs, you get to see the same directors, same rotation of directors crop up. There's, you know, a pool of, you know, guys like Tim Van Patten or Steve Buscemi. So they, you know, possibly, if once you get into that crowd, then maybe it's easy to get the call back, or they say, all right, well, we'll use you for 4 or 5 episodes per 13 episode season or something like that. So, you know, you get nowadays that we're always sort of saying that a lot of the shows on cable network that have really great writing, it's possibly, you know, something that she's quite happy with, you know, given that, cinema for a lot of people, it's all become, how many McDonald's cups can we sell on this franchise for this film? Whereas a lot of the quality writing is going into TV, so she'd probably be more than happy to be part of a pool that they keep coming back to for these cable network shows, if that's what she's working on.
Yeah, I want to say, like, Lexi Alexander has spoken about that too, and I like her a lot too, but yeah, it definitely seems to me.
I was going to say, I think in that industry, in the TV industry, I think if you prove that you're capable, you can go in and you can do this job, because, you know, they crank out so much. You know, your average American TV show has somewhere between 13 and, 26 episodes per year. It's an awful lot of work. So, you know, I guess if you're a capable director and you work well with the producers and, you know, the team, then it kind of makes sense that they keep asking you back to do that. So.
Oh, like, here's an example. Leslie Linka Glatter. She directs Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, Mad Men, The Wire. Like, she's worked on some amazing...
She's done everything, hasn't she?
Breaking Bad. Yeah, and, you know, you would think that she'd be more of a household name, because considering she's done, like, every reputable show the past 10 years. Yeah.
Looking at Anders' IMDb as well, she made a film in 2001 I haven't seen called Things Behind the Sun. The premise to which a young music journalist's dark memories are awakened when he goes to interview a female rock singer, and both are forced to confront troubling secrets from their pasts. And that sounds rather interesting. That's got a pretty good write-up and an interesting cast. That might be one to check, eh?
We'll file that away.
Things Behind the Sun.
So as long as
not to be confused with Men Behind the Sun.
As long as it's not Men Behind the Sun.
No, definitely not Men Behind the Sun.
I just wanted to mention one more thing related to God Give Me Strength. I have a note here, and Bernie, I'll run this by you. We were speaking about the American Music Club before, and I dearly love to hear Mark Eitzel do a cover of God Give Me Strength. I think he would do so much justice to it.
Do you know, funnily enough, when I was watching the end credits and the song was playing, I thought, man, it totally reminded me of the album we did on Love That Album, 60 yeah. Watt Silver Lining.
Yes, yes. Ah, so, yeah. Yep, yep.
It just, I would love to hear that, yeah. I'll give Mark a shout. I'll see if I can get it sorted, Morris.
Well, look, you're a friend to the stars, you know.
I hang around with you guys, so...
No, but I'm talking about people. Truth. like XTC, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
Well.
Now, do we want to wrap it up?
Just so quickly, I wonder what you guys thought about the kind of period setting and how, I mean, obviously we mentioned the wigs and the clothing and so on. Do you think, I mean, personally, I find a lot of movies which are set in recent history, they don't look authentic, because I don't know, maybe we're not far enough removed period. But do you think this works?
When this movie came out, I worked as a recording engineer. And so I really enjoyed seeing sort of the progression of the studios. I enjoyed seeing, like, specifically how they changed the equipment and the, you know, the console. Like, I enjoyed those little touches. But yeah, like the wardrobe in the 60s,
so they got that
way. But the wardrobe in the 60s just was hilariously bad. But I feel like that happens all the time.
Yeah,
I think that's par for the course, isn't it, with this kind of film, unfortunately.
I guess, especially when you're telling a film like over a 10, 12 year period, that clothing has to be there as a signpost. If they're not going to put on the screen 1967 in 69. The clothes are the signpost. Okay, we've moved forward.
It's a really sort of cheap and easy way to signify the passage of time, isn't it? Oh, here's the flared trousers and the peasant blouse. So, yeah.
As soon as Matt Dillon showed up in that Baja shirt, that was the end of everything.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing I was going to say that really kind of made me feel sad about this whole film was that, you know, I know that it's like we were saying, it was loosely based on true people, you know, but the whole craft of songwriting and the whole craft of, you know, putting together an amazing composition and the whole history of where we've come from, you know, and the evolution, you know, to eventually reach the point of where we wind up with such profound lyrics as baby, 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 ooh. Baby, 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 ooh. I mean, we've come so far, haven't we? No, I mean, you know, it just bums me out when I see like, you know, people who were true artists, you know, and were just so amazingly proficient at, you know, putting together arrangements and these songs and things, and then I look today where anybody with, you know, simple laptop, you know, they just sort of get this nonsense, you know, and it just makes me laugh.
I'm sure that those song craftsmen and women are out there still doing things, doing clever things with their laptop. I'm sure that those people who sort of sit in their room and still sort of slave over every last word to make sure that it's just absolutely perfect, which is the impression I get of those Brill Building songwriters.
See, but then once again, like it's just like how different is baby, 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 ooh, from, you know, da do 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 da 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 da, or like Ayla's nonsense kind of song. You know, I always feel like lyrics. I don't know. I could go on forever, but I feel like lyrics are kind of nonsense anyway. You know, I just what do I know? I listen to drums.
You're more music than lyrics.
Yeah.
Oh, you're not going to go trash the lyrics. There goes like 2/3 of my other podcast. Holy shit. Now, look, I mean, I think even... here's the thing for me with well-crafted lyrics. I mean, not necessarily well-crafted lyrics, but if you have a song that's a whole package, and this is where I take notion with those people who say that, oh, good song lyrics are like poetry. No, they're not. Lyrics and poetry serve different functions. And you can listen to a song that's a great song overall, and you can sing the lyrics along to the song and not think that they're a bunch of shit. But if you go, like, you know, to say, like, early Beatles singles, and really, you know, She Loves You, Yeah, 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 it's maybe a little bit embarrassing if you sort of think about the word, you think you lost your love, I saw her yesterday, and it's, you know, it's no great shakes, nothing great that's profound, but as a song overall, it works, and that's a lot to do with this period. It was factory and they put things out, and the songs of that time work well as songs. And I think what you're saying, Tim, right, is nowadays, yeah, the songs don't necessarily work well as songs. The lyrics fail and they don't even have a decent song to work with. Whereas, you know, back in that time, maybe the lyrics could still be somewhat askew, but they still sort of work well as an overall composition because they've taken to arrange it and they've picked the right words for the right moment.
Yeah, for sure. But you know what? I mean, you know, not to go off on a tangent here, but one really funny thing I just wanted to quickly mention was that a lot of times, you know, in my job, you know, working with my students, I incorporate music.
Mm.
And, you know, and I've used, you know, the Beatles All Together Now. And, you know, I use that and I've used Yellow Submarine. So, you know, what's really funny is, you know, you get a group of students singing, we all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine. They're all singing along. And then, you know, one guy says, you know, in Korean, well, what does that mean? And then, you know, the other guy says, it doesn't matter.
And yet he's,
you know, and that,
got the gist, yeah.
Yeah, that's just it, is that, you know, so many of the Beatles' lyrics were nonsensical, but there was something behind it. There was a melody, there was, you know, a foundation, you know what I mean? And I think that's the difference, you're right, is that, you know, today it just seems like it's just, you know, But in the past, even when there were goofy lyrics, there was at least some type of catchy song or a jingle behind it.
You know? Well, that's it. I think a song will work if it has a catchy melody or refrain and bad lyrics.
Yeah.
But a song with a bad melody and great lyrics isn't going to work so well, is it?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, do you guys remember Steve Allen? The old comedian, he used to do songs where he would do them deadpan. Do you remember him doing that? Where, like, he would do, like, for example, the Beatles, She Loves You, and he would come out smoking a cigarette, and he'd be like, She loves you. Yeah. Yeah? Yeah. She loves you. Yeah?
Like the William Shatner album.
Yeah.
Have you heard Peter Sellers do the Dr. Strangelove take on that? She loves you. Yeah? 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 She loves.
Nice.
I saw her yesterday. It's you she's thinking of, and she told me what to say. She told me she loves you. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So it's not funny. What you got; it's what you do with it.
Right.
All right. So let's wrap this up. Otherwise, we could talk about lyrics versus melody all night long.
All right.
So whose turn is it? Whose turn is it for the next film?
It's Tim's.
Tim, what are we going with?
Well, we're. Going with, I think I'd mentioned it last time, but we had to postpone it because I wasn't going to be around, but we worked it out. We're going to go with, you can go into old Uncle Morris's neck of the woods with a good old beer-drinking bunch of Yabos from Australia, but a band, the Cosmic Psychos. We're going to do a documentary called Blokes You Can Trust.
Yeah.
Very fun documentary.
Nice. You're in the pub.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if this film don't make you thirsty, nothing will.
Looking forward to that. And I should probably also say the month after that, we had a really wonderful response to our post on the See Here Facebook page. We want to have about four films this year from listeners to the show, just as our way of saying thank you for listening to us. So come April, we're going to be doing the first of the listener picks for See Here. Now, I can't remember who chose it, but I remember that the film was You're Gonna Miss Me, a documentary about Rocky Erickson.
Rocky.
So that'll be Rocky. Is it Rocky? Excuse me.
Yeah, it's always pronounced Rocky, yes? I know I've seen this documentary. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
There you go. At least I can say twat right, Bernie.
Yes.
I know certain.
Honestly, you people.
No, I get it right. So no, it's James Curley. James Curley. So he'll be. It's his pick in April, and maybe we'll see if we can get him on the show if he wants to. Oh no, he says he wants to remain a listener for now. So no, he's not going to come up. But anyway, that's April. But yeah, so next month, Blokes You Can Trust, the Cosmic Psychos. You would have heard the Cosmic Psychos, Bernie, would you?
Yes. Yeah. Of course. Yes. Yeah.
Wendy.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all right. Well, really looking forward to this. That'll be, so that's next month. Excellent.
All right. So, wrapping up, we are See Here, and we will see here you next month.
Now I have nothing, so God, give me strength. I'm weak in his way, but if I'm strong, I might still break, and I don't have anything to share that I won't throw away into the air. That song is sung. Wipe him from my memory.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.